podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analysts Inside Cricket. Sunday the 25th of September, and still the cricket bandwagon rolls on. Lots to talk about today, including, of course, this dynamic series between England and Pakistan, the T20 series going on in Pakistan at the moment, which is now tied at 2-2. The climax to the county championship comes up next week. We've got the men's high performance review recommendations, and we've got a mankad in a women's international. So it's a cricket never sleeps, Simon.
It certainly does. And welcome back from holiday, Oz, by the way. Did you have a nice time in Greece? I saw some.
Yeah, amazing.
I saw some of your.
Yeah, no cricket, though.
Well, I saw some of your photographs on Instagram and I was extremely jealous. Clear blue skies, lovely blue sea, warm weather, the like of which we're not going to see for about another 7 months or something like that.
And I suppose that means that you'll only manage to wear your shorts for another month.
Listen.
And by November, you're going to have to get the long johns on.
My wife has already turned the central heating on. What about that, eh?
That is the definition of SAD, isn't it? Sad, seasonal affective disorder, which I used to have a friend, actually, that got so affected by it that during the winter, he used to wallpaper his studio with aluminium foil to just make sure it was bright and warm inside his indoor space in November and December, those gloomy months. Luckily, it didn't catch fire.
Well, let's talk about the cricket then. We've got a long winter ahead of us, but let's talk about the cricket. And there's a lot to talk about. I thought today, I've seen all four T20 matches between England and Pakistan. I thought today was a tremendous game because it fluctuated, didn't it? I mean, we actually had four very different games in this series. T20 can be a bit formulaic, but all the games have been very different, and today was an absolute blockbuster, I thought, because you didn't know who was going to win it. It went one way and then the other, and then halfway stage you thought England had the advantage, then a 14 for 3, they thought they're out of it, then a partnership, and then a collapse, and then a partnership, and then ultimately a collapse. Just a brilliant game of cricket, actually, for a sellout crowd.
And big commiserations to poor Liam Dawson, who was a hero and then almost a villain in the space of three balls. He played a brilliant innings, didn't he? An absolute cameo towards the end when England were out of it, and he took 24 off and over and played the... It wasn't lucky shots either. They were so well-calculated shots. And, you know, he seemed to almost know what the bowler was going to bowl and be ready with the right stroke. And, it was effortless in a way, the way he took the runs and then got England to within 9 of victory, then got out. And then suddenly Pakistan, as they often do, burst through that half-open door and stole victory from the jaws of defeat, didn't they?
You can look at a couple of things. Dawson's stroke, did he need to play that shot with a handful of runs needed? I mean, you're in the sort of the adrenaline's flowing. It was a short ball. And he sort of helped it on its way, didn't he, into the leg side and was caught. I had a look at Ollie Stone, actually, because he was cleaned up first ball. I had a look at how much cricket he's had in the middle, batting in the middle of late. He did play in a second 11 game in July and he made 92 not out in a second 11 game. You know, he can bat. He's not the worst, lower order player, tail ender. But the last time he played in a sort of list day or sort of proper match was like early July, so that's over two and a half months ago since he batted in the middle. So he got cleaned up first ball, and then there was just a bit of desperation, wasn't there? Rhys Topley was on strike. He's not the best batter lower down the order, so anything you get from him is a bonus. But in the end, they gambled, didn't they? There wasn't a run there, and they gambled on getting it. I mean, they had time in that last over, didn't they? There were still four balls to go. I mean, Topley could have waited for something that was wide off the stumps and tried a carving, slicing shot. But I don't know. You get caught up in the moment, and they gambled on the single. It's far too tight. into the onside, Sean Massoud hitting the stumps from quite close range. And what a turnaround for Sean Massoud, because when he was dismissed, he was really struggled with the bat. When he was dismissed, the crowd actually cheered. And then some of them, towards the end of the game, left the stadium. And then when they announced that Sean Massoud was the man who ran out Reece Topley, it was a huge cheer. So Sean Massoud, it's fair to say Sean Massoud's day got, you know, quite well, got better. Let's put it that way.
They have a habit, don't they, of in both India and Pakistan, actually, when somebody loses the game for their country, there are occasions where they burn effigies of players, don't they, or sort of portraits of them or something. And they would have been starting to burn his effigy and then quickly put it out and extinguished it because he suddenly became a hero. I mean, you have to hand it to Pakistan. And they keep coming up with brilliant bowlers in particular. And I know Harris Ralph has been around a bit now, but, you know, he came through a talent search programme. No one had really heard of him. He took up hardball cricket really quite late in his sort of mid-teens, mid to late teens, and then won this talent search contest. And, I mean, he's such a brilliant bowler. And when I saw him bowl out Ollie Stone there, I mean, I just had immediate kind of recollections of facing Malcolm Marshall myself. And when a bowler is on it like that and is suffused by adrenaline, there is no doubt that gives you that extra bit of pace. And one of those deliveries in that final over was 155 kilometres an hour, which is, you know, close to what Mark Wood produced the day before, the match before. That's mid-90s mile an hour. You've got to face that, having not faced, as you say, any bowling at all for a couple of months or more. And I just remember facing Malcolm Marshall, first ball, he just knocked over a couple of other people. And, you know, that sort of whole image of him sort of hustling to the wicket, just like Harris Ralph does, small of stature, but absolutely massive in terms of potency. And he just, when you get that ball, that perfect ball on, say, just outside off stump, hitting the top of off at 90 miles an hour, and it's your first ball, you just, it's all over in such a, in a flash, and you just, you sort of wonder whatever happened. And I can remember that happening to me with Marshall, and Ollie Stone just looked totally sort of bemused, as if he never really saw it at all, and it just took him out. And I sort of quite applauded Reece Topley for surviving a couple of balls off, or at least one ball off Harris Ralph. And then, yeah, I mean, you know, panic sets in. Suddenly, the obvious victory is, has receded to a sort of faint hope, and you just think, I've got to get this guy on strike. I've got to get Rashid back on strike. And, well, you, I suppose Reece Topley, thinking four big strides of him would get him to the other end. But, again, Pakistan, brilliant fielding. You know, one opportunity to run out and they took it.
I mean, their fielding wasn't perfect, it has to be said. I mean, there was an incredible drop of Harry Brook. Mohammad Nawaz dropping him at extra cover. It's actually been a series of remarkable drops. Alex Hales has dropped a couple of goobers. And who was it? There was another.
The lights aren't that
well,
good,
it could
are
be
they?
That, yeah.
In Karachi. Well, it was actually, there was a couple of boundaries in this match where the fielder on the boundary sort of looked as if he thought the ball was going to hit him on the head, and then suddenly saw it land 2 yards, a few yards in front, and sort of grasped vainly for it, and the ball evaded his grasp. So I think the lights, being as they are sort of all round and quite low, I think they, that glare and the white ball sort of glinting as well in the atmosphere, I think sometimes it does make it very hard to pick up in the
field.
Yeah,
well, it could be that. I think it was Iftikhar who dropped an absolute goober on the boundary as well. I mean, just, it was a nonchalant one. He just went forward to, you know, almost like a lob out to the deep, and he dropped it earlier in the series. So there have been a few remarkable drops in the series, and Brook benefited from one today.
No, you mentioned Harry Brook. I mean, wow, what a player he is. He hit a shot today, which, it's not a new shot down the wicket to a left arm spinner and over extra for six, but the poise, the panache and the power of the shot was remarkable. It just cannoned into the fence 20 yards back from the boundary rope, and it was done with the most sort of elegant ease and just a simple extension of the arms, a balance. The sort of follow through was quite short. It was just absolutely, I think Mark Butcher called it splendiferous.
He did, yeah.
And it was an incredible shot. And actually, I've been very impressed with the way he's played in all the games, because not just the power and the range of shots, but the decision-making. you know, which we've been so critical of someone like Zach Crawley in Test cricket, for instance. He's got the shots, but he just plays them at the wrong time. And clearly, he's a smart guy, Harry Brook, because you can see he's read the pitch. And the, for instance, today, Will Jacks went for a pull to a ball which wasn't all that short. It's the sort of kind of shot he would probably play at the Oval and hit for six. But there's not as much bounce in Karachi, and it skids on. And he got done clean bowled. Well, Harry Brooks saw that, realised that sort of length. It wasn't that sort of shot to play. So he played it a different way. I just think he looks very much like Joe Root in the, how he thinks about what are the shots, the percentage shots for this particular situation. And with the kind of statuesque style of Michael Vaughan, it's almost like a Vaughan Root, the head of Root and the body of Vaughan sort of thing. And with some shots of Peterson. I mean, it's quite a combination.
It's not bad, is it? If you can put those three together, he does look a very special talent. He's 23 years of age, 24 next February. I wonder whether he, you know, in this series, he's advanced his case significantly enough to get him into the starting lineup in the T20 World Cup that's coming up in Australia. Different sort of pitches, of course. He's in the sort of provisional 15 that England have selected for that tournament. And, you know, has he gone ahead of one or two? It's interesting.
Well, I think definitely. I mean, I think it's like the situation with Jofra Archer before the World Cup, that he just made an inescapable case for his inclusion. And all the stats said with Archer, all the stats said, look, he's performed at very high level, you know, IPL, Big Bash, etc., big crowds, big pressure, international opposition, calibre of opposition. You know, he's got it. He's a shoo-in. And I think this is the case with Harry Brook as well. I mean, he's just showed such accomplishment and level of ability at you know, against very high quality opposition. So, I don't know. I think they'd be mad not to include him.
I mean, my feeling was just, you know, seeing him in various games this summer that he was actually ready to make his test debut. But of course, there was no spot in the team until right at the end of the season when Johnny Best got injured. And so he was drafted in to play at the Oval. He played a rather sort of frenetic, skittish sort of innings at the Oval, but very much in keeping with the way England were trying to play in that test match, wasn't he? He was like, he read the instructions and, you know, and followed them to the letter of the law, really, in that match at the Oval, caught at fine leg. I mean, there aren't many batters on their test debut who early on are caught at fine leg, not playing for England anyway. You're normally nicking off, aren't you, or something like that, or LBW, but yeah, you know, caught at fine leg playing the pool shot. So he, you know, he bought into that. But you sort of felt he deserved to play earlier in the summer, but there wasn't a spot for him unless, you know, they decided to pitch him in as a makeshift opener. There was a spot at the top, wasn't there, when the two openers were struggling, but they persevered with them. And Harry Brook has opened a bit in the past, but they decided they, you know, I was talking to James Taylor the other day, you know, the former chief scout, and he was saying, you know, he sees him as a, you know, he's a middle order player, really, you know, 4-5 type player. He also said as well that, you know, he is one player that, you know, he really was, when he saw him, you know, really raving about. And Will Jacks was another, in more in white ball cricket, but could also, you know, play all three formats as well. So those are the two that James Taylor picked out.
And I sort of almost see a little bit at times of Rohit Sharma in Harry Brook as well. The innings in the previous game where he got 80-odd, he was playing that shot that Sharma plays, which is a sort of pick-up from a short of a length ball and about off stump. And he sort of just moves across into line and just helps it away for six over square leg. That, again, using the levers he's got, he's tall, he's got, you know, quite long arms, and just the ease with which he puts a fast, just slightly short of a length ball away over square leg was just incredible. And also, I've seen him take some brilliant catches as well, running in from long on, throwing himself to the ground, picking it up just off the ground, going at full tilt. So he's got that asset as well. I just, you know, absolutely exceptional.
Yeah, he's one to look forward to, I think. Oh, no, I don't think we're sort of over-talking him. He just looks to have that sort of star quality that you need at that sort of age to be a success. Of course, he'll have some lows on the way, and, you know, one of those, most players, aren't they? They're dropped at some point. Even Joe Root was dropped at one point. There aren't many that haven't been dropped, but, you know, he does look like a sort of banker
for England in all three formats of the game. One other thing you did touch on, Mark Wood. It was great to see Mark Wood back. And goodness me, Bolas, I mean, to come back, he hasn't played, he played a club match, didn't he? But he hasn't played a proper match since early March. And to come back and, hit about 97 miles an hour, 96, 97 miles an hour in his first game, it was remarkable. He apparently was extremely tired afterwards. I'm not surprised about all the build up, the adrenaline and effort going into it. But it was actually, he really gave the Pakistan batters the hurry up in the game he played. He bowled exceptionally well. It was remarkable actually to see a player come back and do that well in their first game. He took 3 for 25, and he caused Babar Azam some problems. And of course, he didn't play today. England have been mixing and matching a bit in this series. They've got 20 players out there. But, good to see Wood back. I suppose it's how much England can now get him on the field consistently for the matches ahead. And they've got a bit of preparation time with still three games left here, three in Australia before the T20 World Cup starts for them on the 22nd of October in Perth against Afghanistan.
Yeah, I'm so pleased to see Mark Wood come back like that, because I worry about anything like elbow injuries. I really worry about them. I had one myself. I definitely felt after damaging my elbow quite badly that I lost probably 2 or 3 miles an hour. And I feared for Wood as well. Obviously, we're in a different era now where rehab and physio and surgery and everything are much better. But the credit to him and his team, the people who've been working with him, because to come back even stronger and even faster is fantastic. And I hope that Jofra Archer is invigorated by that as well, because you do feel with injuries that you're never going to be quite the same. I'm talking a day before I have a hip replacement. And I'm sort of hoping that my hip could be a lot better than it has been for about the last 10 years. So I sort of, in a way, identify with Wood and his success, and hope it continues.
One other player who's caught my eye to some extent in this tournament, the series, has been Ben Duckett, actually, who it went under the radar a bit that when Johnny Bairstow was injured at the Oval, Duckett was the man that was called in. So the selectors clearly feel he's very close to the Test match team, almost like the next in line, judging by that. They played Brook, of course, because Brook was already in the squad, but Duckett was called in. And he did have a sort of brief international career around about 2016, and things went a bit wrong. There was the Jimmy Anderson incident in Perth, where he was supposed to have poured a pint of beer over his head. But he's only, 27, 28, and batters work it out. He was young when he played, come back, perhaps sorted his game out. And actually, for subcontinental conditions, he looked very well organised. He was very strong on the sweep, both orthodox and reverse sweep. It has got him out a couple of times in this T20 series, admittedly, but he's also played several scintillating strokes. So there's a World Cup in India next 50 over World Cup in 13 months time, so he might be someone that could be an option in those conditions, especially Ben Stokes is not going to be there, for example. So Duckett is sort of pushing his name forward, and he's done himself no harm at all in the last week or so.
Yeah, it's funny how these things happen to players in their youth. They do things that they regret. There was another story about Ben Duckett and an England coach on an aeroplane, which wasn't too savoury either, and so clearly sort of fell out of favour, a bit like Stokes and some of the things he's done. But you grow up, you grow wiser, people forgive you, thank goodness, and as they have with Alex Hales, and you come back stronger, and as Stokes has obviously proved, and perhaps that's the case with Ben Duckett as well. Undoubtedly an incredible talent, just sort of at times a bit off the radar for behaviour, but maybe now he's got a sensible head on and can still use that talent to England's great advantage.
I know it's been a riveting series. Actually, you think seven matches, that's going to test all our patience. All the games are going to be quite similar. They've all been very different. I mean, we've had sort of dramatic things happening. We've had the Wood performance. You've seen that double century chase. I mean, incredible game that second match. When you think that Pakistan won by 10 wickets, yet they won in the final over. I mean, that doesn't. That can't happen very often in T20 cricket. England winning the first game, Pakistan coming back within the second. Tremendous batting by England in the third game with scoring 221. And then an incredible game today. It actually sort of, fills you with great anticipation for the three matches in Lahore now. It hasn't felt, not from a distance anyway, it hasn't felt a slog, a bind watching this series. I can't wait for the next game. It's been really good.
If the teams are well matched and you get that sort of unpredictability as well, it does keep you engaged, doesn't it? And it obviously helps with a big crowd, all absolutely passionate and up for it. And I mean, the way that they live through the game, you can see it's like a Bollywood movie, isn't it? It's either absolutely, victorious and exclaiming and happy, or devastated. It's tragicomic almost, isn't it? The way the crowd react. So that adds to the whole event.
Yeah, it's been thoroughly enjoyable. And we've got three more to come in Lahore in the next week. Well, let's move on, Yoz, away from England. Now, what should we talk about next? Should we talk about Surrey winning the county championship? Should we talk about events at Lords?
No, we can't talk about that. Surrey, Middlesex's arch rivals. And Middlesex, interestingly, are engaged in a sort of three-way fight for promotion to the First Division. It's about time Middlesex were back in the First Division, I have to say. But Surrey, at the moment, riding top of the table. Well done to them for winning the championship. Is it the fourth time this century, I think? It's a pretty impressive record they've got. How do they do it? They just have very good players and they're very good pitches. I think those two things help them massively. Interestingly, in the table, they've actually won less games than Hampshire in second place, but they've lost none. So I suppose it proves that bonus points and good scoring and a good potent attack in the end, even if you don't win the games, then at least you're bowling teams out and scoring lots of runs yourselves, that is rewarded.
Yeah, one thing that we can actually segue into the Strauss review, and one of the proposals is that there's a new point scoring system in the county championship, which is nothing for a loss, one for a draw, and three for a win, and then bonus points if you get certain scores. So it's over 325 to 399 in any innings, you get an extra point, and if you score over 400 in innings, you get an extra point as well. So the most you can get in a game, as I understand it, is 5 points. So, and apparently someone's worked it out, and I don't know if this is true. One of the messages on our WhatsApp group on the World's Best Cricket Club says that if we had the current, that point system, rather than the current one, that Hampshire actually would have won the title or would win the title. I don't know what that proves. But I mean, one thing you would say, of course, is that you would play the games differently, wouldn't you? So it's all very well to say that, but your approach to a match and pitch preparation, for example, is completely different as well. And that's the idea behind one of the planks behind the Strauss review is pitch preparation, that you play on good pitches where it's harder to take wickets, batters learn to play properly, bowlers learn to bowl in test match conditions, and also proposing to use the Kookaburra ball as well to make it almost doubly difficult, because it's, as we know, it's quite hard using the Kookaburra ball in in Australia. It favours the batters after a first 15 overs.
I sort of feel that with the Strauss report overall, that there's a lot of data they've consumed and spat out to use in their recommendations, and something like a figure like 324 or 325 for bonus points it seems almost like just making the game more complicated than it needs to be. And following that and trying to remember, okay, so they got to 325, so that's an extra point or whatever. I mean,
that's quite straightforward,
well,
isn't it?
Why can't they just keep it simpler and have it 300 or 350 or 400 or something? I mean, it's almost like data ruling the world now. And, that is the optimum score. I just think it's overcomplicating it, really. But, well done to them for the investigation. You quite like it, do you?
Well, no, I would argue it's simpler than the current bonus point system, isn't it? Where you get 1 for 200, 2 for 250, 3 for 300.
Well, that's in keeping with cricket's sort of almost obsession with centuries and half centuries, 50s and 100s. You know, they are numbers that we can all identify with. The 325 sounds like one of those quiz questions, which is the only score that's never been made by a batsman in a Test match. And it's probably Andy Saltzman will tell us it's...
I think it's 227, isn't it? Or something like that. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I've got vague
memory. I don't think it's 227. I think Kevin Peterson made 227 in an Adelaide Test, actually.
Okay, whatever. We won't argue about that. We'll have to go and research. But it's somewhere in that sort of area. Anyway, we were talking about the Strauss Review, and bonus points is one of them. All sorts of things. 17 recommendations that have been made. And 15 of them the ECB can sort of pass through, and that, you know, there are all sorts of things like England under 17 team, the Kookaburra ball, fast bowlers overseas, better pitches, longer central contracts, the change to the point system, sort of coaching overhaul, structure overhaul, all sorts of things like that. But the one that's the most contentious, it seems, because there's been a lot of reaction to it, is the plan to reduce the county championship from 14 to 10 matches, have three divisions, or a first division and two second divisions, and also reduce the blast by four matches. So you go from 14 group games to 10 group games. And it strikes me this is going to be very difficult to get through, because there's a lot of self-interest in cricket, isn't there? There's a lot of people who are sort of have got their own viewpoint to protect. So if you're a chief executive of a county club, you don't want, say, one of the smaller county clubs, you don't want a reduction in blast matches, because those two extra games bring in, you know, quite a significant amount of money. You know, if you're a member of a county club, you don't want a reduction in the number of matches, because you want, you know, value for money for your membership. If you're a director of cricket, you probably want to play fewer matches. If you're a chief executive, you want to play more matches. So even within a club, you might have that, you know, dispute between sort of two of your leading figures. Do you understand what I mean? So the chief executive might want to play more matches, and the director of cricket want to play fewer, because he or she, whatever, can see the demands on the players. So that, and if, you know, if you're looking from an England point of view, you want England to do well, you want England to win in Australia, you want England to win in India, but does a chief executive of a county want England to win in India or Australia particularly? Mm. Or, you know, actually, do they want their club to thrive?
I mean, you're absolutely right. Every county's got it's like little fiefdoms, isn't it? Every county has its own financial and cultural and social agenda. Mm. And it's difficult to satisfy everyone. And actually, that's one of the things I said to Tom Harrison when he first took the job as chief executive of the ECB. You'll be prepared for lots of complaints, because county cricket, 18 counties, it's impossible to satisfy even half of them, never mind all of them. You're always going to get issues and complaints and people saying this isn't fair and so on. I mean, I think that reducing the number of county championship matches is probably right, because you do want them to be special. And say 10 games spread across 3.5 months-ish, say maybe 4 months, is about right. The games that then would become that bit more intense, 4-day cricket, you know, going to, if they're on good pitches, as you say, with groundsmen will have to prepare slightly less pitches, which should enable them to produce better pitches. There was complaints recently, wasn't there, about the game at Essex from Lancashire, that, you know, the pitch there was rubbish. So I think that should enable a better standard of cricket. It does deny the members of each individual county some time there, or match time there. But I wonder whether, you know, all the counties should club together, or the ECB should enable all members of county clubs to go to other county matches if their team isn't playing at home. So they go to their next local county instead and get free membership to them. So,
but do they want that? I'm not sure. Yeah,
so you're going to say you'd over my dead body, would I go and watch Somerset instead of Gloucestershire, I suppose. But England is a small country. You can get to most county games, unless you live, you know, in Cornwall and you've got to drive to Durham. You can get to most county games within a couple of hours at the most. And I know that many members... No, you're shaking your head. Obviously, it does depend where you live, right? But I reckon that apart from Cornwall and Devon, most people will live within 2 hours of a county game on an average day in the summer, right? You can get to a county game within a couple of hours, hopefully. And I know members of our world's best cricket club have travelled to different... Like, I remember one guy, he's a Hampshire member, going to Chesterfield and saying how wonderful it was. And so I think we should be encouraging people to go and visit other counties if their county is not playing a home game, yeah. As long as there's something to watch.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be against that. Definitely go and watch another county. But people tend to be not so much in cricket as probably in other sports. But people still want to watch their own county. They're reasonably.
I'm not saying they can't watch their own county, but if their own county's playing miles away, go and watch another county that's a bit nearer.
Yeah,
and get in for free. If you're a member of a particular county, so the membership should be of all the counties rather than individual ones. I haven't thought this through. I'm sure I'm going to be shot down and said, it's just complete sort of theoretical nonsense. But I think the more that counties can collaborate with each other over all sorts of things, like streaming and things like that, for instance, the better, ultimately. Because none of them can be that... It's not easy for individual counties to be viable, to be solvent.
Yeah, it's not the worst idea in the world, but I suppose my question would be, what sort of take-up would there be? To me, John Philby, who's the chair of Sussex, he sort of summed this whole thing up perfectly when he said, Strauss's high performance review is unworkable as far as county cricket is concerned. He said, when looked at through the lens of high performance, it's exactly what the game needs. So high performance is exactly what we need, but we are not looking through the lens of high performance at a county. We are looking through a financial and commercial lens, and we are looking through the eyes of our members. I mean, that in a way that sums it up. It's like, actually the game needs it, but we can't afford it. Or our individual fiefdom, we can't afford to do this.
Look, it's actually a bit like the London Underground. It was built in the 1890s. The world has changed totally, but it's impossible to sort of dig up the underground and start again. Obviously they're adding new lines here and there, but you're stuck with a sort of Piccadilly line that weaves all over the place and makes incredible noise, or the Northern line that fails half the time and things, and the
or the district line that creeps along.
Yeah. Or the hot tunnels in about 4 months of the year and, escalators that don't work. You're stuck with the tube as it is. So you've got to make the best of it. Well, county cricket's a bit like that, but occasionally you can add a new idea, i.e. the 100, and sort of try and move it forward a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other interesting thing, actually, the 100. I mean, that is, sort of like the elephant in the room, isn't it? And there seems to be a lot of opposition from perhaps traditional members about towards the 100, and then it's stuck its great big bottom in in August, right across that August, and there's no room for anything else, and there's a lot of discontent about that. And yet, if you're the chief executive of one of the bigger counties, you're thinking, hold on a second, there are people coming to my ground, and they're spending money, they're buying their tickets, but they're also spending on all sorts of other things as well, all the hospitality, the drink, the food, all that sort of stuff. And those counties are doing pretty well out of it. So the big counties. So you've got that sort of self-interest as well. That for the bigger counties, I think they're pretty happy with the 100 and what the 100 is delivering. Albeit that perhaps last season, I don't know, the standard wasn't quite as high, and the matches were, there weren't that many close matches, and some of the star names weren't available. So I mean, what they're going to do with this Strauss review, I don't know. The championship, I imagine, I don't know. Imagine unless there's a way of sort of strong arming the counties into voting for it, I don't see how they're going to get that aspect of it through, the reduction in number of days played.
It's quite funny, actually, because if you look at the layout of a proposed 2024 season, it starts with a one-day cup, then it's got May, June, July, you've got championship and blast, so you've got championship and sort of short format in Friday nights and things like that. And then you've got August, you've got festival cricket and the 100. And then September, you go back to the championship. Well, that's what we had in about 1984, apart from the 100. That was exactly what we had. We had championship. We had Benson Edges Cup, April and early May, championship through to sort of mid-August, or most of August, with a few festival matches thrown in. Cheltenham, that was my favourite. What a great venue that was. Fantastic pitch, marquees all around the ground, Pims if you were batting all day. And, you know, just a great atmosphere, fantastic place. And taking the game to the shires, taking the game to the clubs, to the schools, to all those sort of different venues to give it a bit of variety as well. And then the sort of climax in September. So it was what we had about 30 years ago, really.
Yeah, exactly. As you rightly say, that you did not have the 100, which is, you know, one of the big.
Well, we had the Nat West. Issues. We had the Nat West Trophy.
Yeah, but that was
formerly the Gillette Cup, which was a knockout, which is not like the 100 because the 100 is more of a league. But it was sort of like the 100 in a way.
No, it wasn't. It was one game.
By the time you got to the last eight, it was like the 100, but it was a knockout, and so there was even more pressure.
Yeah, more pressure, but there was no. But you know, it didn't sit right across August. It was just 3 or 4 days. That's the point. And also, you talk about festival cricket. I mean, are you going to sort of I think sort of the idea is to sort of manufacture some festival cricket. I don't know, have a sort of London Cup or something, or a sort of a Roses match
that's
or something.
All right. I think I quite like that because I mean there are what is it 100 of the top Red Bull players in
what
the
are they
country
playing
not
for, though?
Playing.
That's a fifth competition.
Cricket.
Well, you're talking about fifth competition.
Well, they need to play some cricket, don't they? These guys, 100 players, not playing, Red Bull players, not playing in the 100. Look at Josh Atherton, known as Josh De Carey's. He's not Josh Atherton, he's Josh De Carey's, Michael Atherton's son. He couldn't find any cricket in August. He wasn't in the 100. He didn't get in the Royal London Middlesex Cup side. And there was no second 11 cricket. So he was sat on his arse on trying to find matches for Hertfordshire and things. I mean, that's terrible in August. There's no cricket.
Yeah, no, it's a problem. I suppose what I'm saying is, will people want to go and watch festival games? I don't know. Perhaps they do. Perhaps there might be some Lions games on. I think that was another idea, playing the Lions game in August. Anyway, it'll all come out in the wash, and I expect England will next win in Australia in about the 22nd century and India in the 23rd century. but I mean, you know, there are other proposals which hopefully will improve the England team. I suppose from my perspective, I do look at it. I think the game benefits from England doing. I mean, when England win the Ashes in Australia, the very infrequent times, it gives the game a massive lift, doesn't it? Don't you think? And the interest is phenomenal when that's happening. So I mean, that's the ideal, I think. But also, you know, there are other interests in the game that you have to cater for as well, and Andrew Strauss is trying something quite radical. Probably some of it will get knocked back, I imagine, and the England team will just sort of see how it gets on in the future. There's a lot of white ball talent around there, a lot of white ball batting talent anyway, as we were discussing earlier in the podcast. Shall we end today, Yoz, talking about events at Lord's on Saturday late afternoon, early evening? It's a subject that we've talked about before. I remember when Sri Lanka played England at Edgbaston, I think it was in 2014, when Jos Buttler was run out by, was it Senanayake?
Yeah, the off-spinner,
Backing up, and there was a whole hullabaloo about it then. The law is very clear. It's been sort of tweaked, and it requires the batter to stay in his or her ground. It's unequivocal, and it says, you know, it's a fair, if you like, whatever you want to describe as fair mode of dismissal. I mean, to me, it just seems really simple. You just stay in your ground, you know. And if you're out of your ground, then you are vulnerable. I put that view forward on Twitter on Saturday night, and there was, you know, quite a lot of support for it. But also, it's really weird as well, the level of abuse there is out there as well about something like this, which is, you know, it's a fairly esoteric sort of happening in a game, isn't it, really? I suppose what the problem on Saturday was that it sort of ultimately decided quite an exciting game. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of running someone out backing up. But I think the bottom line is, as a batter, you just say to yourself, I will not be dismissed in that way. I will make sure that I'm in my ground. And so you're not vulnerable to it. That's how I see it. To me, it's absolutely, you know, totally straightforward.
It's cut and dried for you.
For a lot of people say it's against the spirit of the game. It's disgusting, disgraceful, cowardly, all those sorts of things. I don't think it's one of the great aspects of the game. But if you didn't allow it to happen, It's a bit like, you know, it's like standing on the curb, isn't it? If you didn't walk into the road, you wouldn't get knocked down. Let the car pass.
You make a strong argument. I think it, personally, I feel it sullies, in this case, the, you know, the women playing an international at laws, which has been such a sort of male domain for so long. And, you know, finally the women are being allowed to play internationals at laws, which is fantastic. And it's a shame that an event like that is sullied, in my view, by the last wicket being taken by a mancad.
Why is it even sullied, Yoz?
Well,
what do you mean by sullied?
Because it's cynical. I think it's cynical. Mm. It's legal. It's yes, it's in the laws. And you're quite right. The batter should stay in their
ground.
So's
nicking it and not walking. That's cynical as well, isn't it, when you know you're out?
It's not quite as cynical because, I mean, sometimes you're not sure. I mean, yes, all right, Stuart Broad definitely knew when he nicked it at Trent Bridge in 2015. But sometimes with batting, you're not quite sure. I think with this, you know exactly what you're doing. She knew exactly what she was doing, the girl who ran out, Charlie Dean. And I just think it's unnecessary, especially when it's sort of 17 to win with one wicket left and, I don't know, what, 30-odd balls left. I mean, I think it's unnecessary. Now, I mean, obviously, it is in the laws that you can do it and it's legitimate. And I suppose, in a way, to be sympathetic to the batter for a second, you are taught at school, at club, to back up, aren't you? That's one of the first things a coach says to you when you're batting. Don't forget, the non-strikers
end,
back up. And it becomes instinctive that as a bowler runs into bowl, you leave your ground and get ready to run. In the same way as you walk in the field. When the bowler's running in, you walk in the field. You sort of go with the rhythm of the bowler. It doesn't mean you're trying to steal a run every time. It's just you just get into the habit of doing it. And so the first step in this whole scenario is the coaching messages have to change. And probably they are changing, but the messages are getting through slowly. And Charlie Dean, who's been, you know, around the circuit for 10 or 15 years, would have undoubtedly been taught by her early coaches, don't forget to back up. And this would have never happened to her before. I mean, it happened to me in a club match, actually, when I was about 19 or 20, and I was pretty shocked that someone would do that. But I think in my case, it's because they found me sort of slightly offensive as a sort of personality, and they were almost doing it to spite me, sort of take me down a peg. So there was a sort of character assassination going on. But I think with that particular incident, and there's been some in under-19 World Cups, haven't there, to win a game. And I just think it's...
And Ravi Chandranashwin's done it in the IPL.
Well, Ravi Chandranashwin's done it and totally justified it. Yeah. I mean, he was a bit deceptive, I thought, the way he did it, because he was almost walked through his delivery stride and, you know, then sort of suddenly decided to stop and not bowl and let him, you know, flick the stumps or bails. I mean, I just think the best way to do this is if you do see, you sense a batsman trying to steal some ground, you run up to bowl, you stop. And I've done this, by the way. I have done this. You run up to bowl, you stop, and the batter's, you know, followed through down the pitch, out of their ground, and you just say, right, next time you do that, that's a warning. I'll take the bails off.
Yeah.
And they get the message then that you're serious. Doing it just completely out of the blue like that, I just think is unnecessary, really. Yeah. And it's cynical.
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of largely with you that I think that sort of warning, or if you say, you know, it's like, for example, I mean, today, for example, in the match between England and Pakistan, when, you know, when they got to that last over and it was clear they wanted to run, you know, it's clear they wanted to get Rashid up to the striker's end. I think the bowler in that situation would totally be within their rights before giving a warning, saying actually to Adil Rashid, please make sure you stay in your ground. Don't try to pinch any yardage or any inches or whatever, stay in your ground. So, you know, you don't just stop and warn him. We can actually say that legitimately at the start of the over because the game is so tight. And, you know, that puts the, you know, that warning in the batter's mind, and therefore you'd hope they don't do it. So some kind of warning, I would think, is a much better way of going rather than doing it, you know, without any sort of warning or... And yeah, I agree with that totally, and I would advise that. But I still come back to my fundamental point is, as a batter, if you're in your ground, you are not subject to anybody else's morality. You know, if people, Ravi Chandranashwin thinks it's fine, Other people don't, but you're not at the whim of Ravi Chandran Ashwin just knocking the bales off if you're in your ground. There's nothing he can do about it. And that's the only point I would make about it, and that's where I come from. But apparently that is a hugely controversial view for some reason. I don't know, even though it says in the laws of the game, which you passed, yours apparently, your committee,
your committee
passed it.
Yeah,
you're to blame.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, we couldn't not pass it, really, because it was happening more and more. And there is justification to say that a batsman, certain batters are trying to steal a run or stealing ground, and you don't want that to happen. And, you know, I think that the way the law is phrased now is fair, actually, and it's clear. And so, really, you have got only yourself to blame.
Yeah.
But it's a shame when people seize on it and take advantage of it.
Well, one of the points about Senanayake when he ran out Josh Butler at Edgbaston was he said in the previous game, and Butler was involved in a partnership in that game, where they were turning ones into twos. And he was saying, well, you know, they were well down the pitch. And they were just saying, you know, they presumably looked at the video of it and said, look, this is unacceptable. So... And people say things like, oh, she was only just out of her ground, or she wasn't really trying to take advantage. Well, how many DRS reviews of runouts do we see where there's, you know, just a centimetre in it or one frame or whatever? You know, so we know that cricket is a game of small margins. So there we go. Last thing I'm going to say about it, stay in your ground.
And look, you know, it of course, why it gets people up in arms, this kind of thing, in cricket... which is such an upstanding game of virtue and, you know, gentlemanly conduct, which is all a load of bollocks, of course. I mean, I love the story of the man who played for the MCC regularly and captained England in about 1820, Lord Frederick Beauclerk, who was an absolute swindler, who, you know, flashed a watch, his gold watch, in the batsman's eyes when he was running up to bowl, or... had a red handkerchief in his pocket, which he sort of flap around to try and distract batsmen. He rigged matches, and, you know, that was in the 1820s. He had a portrait at Lords for many years, hanging on the walls there. So, you know, the game has forever had these kind of controversies going on, and it will continue, and it gives us something to talk about, doesn't it?
It does. We've talked about it. We've given our views. That's it. I think we've probably said enough about it. Anyway, we're looking forward to the rest of this T20 series. Three matches coming up in Lahore. And then it's on to Australia for all the teams. And the T20 World Cup coming up. It starts in late October. Pakistan's first match at the MCG. A small matter of India on the 23rd of October. England's first game against Afghanistan on the 22nd of October. In... Perth, as you say, the bandwagon rolls on. There's barely a day without cricket happening, even though the nights are drawing in and it's almost time to turn on the radiators
and put your trousers on.
Right,
put your longs on, I should say.
That's it. Welcome back from holiday, and well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to us. I'm sure you probably disagree with some of the things we said, but there we go. That's free speech. Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.